What happens when your land gets fracked?
Well, the first thing that happens is a crew comes in to strip away the vegetation, to cut down any trees that might be there. The land needs to be level, so in terrain like western Pennsylvania that's very mountainous, you need a crew to come in and smooth it down, basically steamroll it. So that's the first thing that happens. When the drilling itself starts, the main disturbance I hear about from people is the noise. And the noise is really epic. It's hard to convey how overpowering it is.
That's novelist Jennifer Haig. We talk with her about her powerful new book, Heat and Light. It's about what happens to a small Pennsylvania community when the frackers come to town. Then, the true story of Jessica Ernst, a Canadian oil patch consultant turned anti-fracking activist.
Well, she's an extraordinary woman, and in many ways, I would argue that the book is actually a tale about the courage of women. And Jessica Ernst did not go looking for this fight, did not want to have any part of it, really. She had worked in Alberta and in northern British Columbia for some of North America's largest oil and gas companies. And like many people in the patch, she thought that the industry was well regulated and that the regulators would uphold the law and do what they were mandated to do. But what she discovered in 2004, when the industry began fracking shallow coal seams around her home in Rosebud, Alberta, in the central part of the province, really shocked her.
That's Andrew Nikiforuk. We talk with him about fracking and the fight against it. His book is Slick Water, Fracking and One Insider Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. So, you've seen the videos where the guy lights the water from his kitchen faucet on fire? That happened when methane from a fracking operation near his house leaked into his well. Contaminating wells and the water table isn't the only threat fracking brings to a community when the drillers come to town. There are other environmental dangers, of course, like noise, earthquakes, and methane leaks that affect not just communities, but our planet. Methane is 25 times more potent a greenhouse gas than CO2. But the social fabric of a community can also fracture when gas and oil companies come with their offers of riches to people who have been struggling for years just to get by. The leases they offered to drill on land promise at first to bring wealth to farmers and workers who have seen agriculture prices plummet and good jobs disappear for several generations. That's what happened to people in Jennifer Haig's fictional town, Bakerton, Pennsylvania, based on the coal town she grew up in. The mining jobs went overseas, and all that's left are low-wage jobs in prisons and nursing homes. Bakerton is a setting for several of Haig's novels, chronicling the hidden injuries of class in Rust Belt America. Her new novel, Heat and Light, is the latest and, I think, the best of her wonderful books. It examines what happens when people are driven to make choices that end up creating unintended consequences for themselves and others. The prison guard who desperately needs money to fulfill his dream of being a dairy farmer like his father. His neighbors, organic dairy farmers whose livelihood is threatened by fracking even before the drilling rigs appear. The anti-fracking activist who doesn't fully consider the impact of his activism on the people he claims to help. Nothing is simple when people without power are forced to make cruel choices by those who hold the reins. Heat and Light was called the best fracking novel ever by the Washington Post. Jennifer Haig is the author of four previous novels, including Faith and The Condition, and the short story collection News from Heaven. We've interviewed her about those books earlier on Writer's Voice. Jennifer Haig, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be back.
Heat and Light. This is a story of what happens to a community where fracking comes in. What drew you to this story?
Well, I grew up in western Pennsylvania, and a lot of my family still lives there. So So this gas drilling question was on my radar from the very beginning. When I started writing Heat and Light, the gas drilling boom was going full force, and there was a pretty vibrant national debate about whether this was a good idea. If you remember, Josh Fox's documentary Gasland had just come out. There was a very heated campaign in New York State to uphold the governor's moratorium on fracking. So it was a politically charged issue at that time. Since then, there have been some developments. Some things have changed. Most significantly, the gas and oil market has tanked. So drilling right now is in a holding pattern. But it's not over. It's a sort of a temporary lull. So this is an ongoing issue.
You seem to have done an enormous amount of research for this book.
I did. There was a real learning curve. You know, fracking is such a very complicated issue. The process itself is technologically complicated. And so just to be able to sort of get my mind around the issue, I had to do a lot of remedial self-education and ask a lot of very stupid questions of a lot of people. So the first year, I was really just learning about it.
Hmm. Wow. So with this novel, you return to Bakerton, which is the fictional Pennsylvania coal town, much like the one you grew up in. It's featured in a number of your books. What's happened to Bakerton since it was a coal town?
The short answer is not a lot. The long answer is it's fairly complicated. When I was growing up, the mines were still going. It had been a coal town at that time for 100 years. And was so until maybe the mid-1980s when things really started to slow down. By the time I was in high school, it was pretty much all over. Most of the people of my generation had to move away to find work somewhere else. There just was not a whole lot for young people to do there. So the people who've stayed in the town are largely retired people, not only, but largely. The population has shrunk. And the whole look of the town is very different. If you drive through it now, there are lots and lots of empty storefronts. The population has so dwindled that in the year 2000, the town council voted to merge with the town next door and give it a whole new name. So the town I grew up in, Barnesboro, Pennsylvania, does not technically exist anymore.
Wow. And, of course, yeah. Bakerton is then a pretty faithful reproduction of this town?
It's sort of a composite of a lot of the towns in that part of Pennsylvania. That's coal country. There were lots of small towns that revolved around coal mining. I fictionalized it to some degree just for expediency. You know, it's one of the privileges of being a novelist, that you can borrow from reality at will, but you're not bound by it. So you pick and choose the features that are useful to you. So I borrowed, you know, the topography of one town, and there might be a diner in another town I liked, and I transposed it to my fictional Bakerton. So I did take some liberties in that way.
So deindustrialization hit this area pretty hard. What happened to the younger people?
Everybody left. The people who stayed are... You know, they're competing for a dwindling number of jobs. There are some nursing homes there, and there are some prisons. So people my age who stayed are a lot of them working in one of those institutions. You know, there are school teachers, there are nurses, but there are fewer children to teach, there are fewer people to nurse. So it's everything has really contracted, and the job market with it.
And so then... the Marcellus Shale. Well, tell us what the Marcellus Shale is, just briefly.
The Marcellus is a shale formation that stretches beneath a good part of the state of Pennsylvania and into New York State, also down into West Virginia. So it's a shale formation that geologists have known for a long time contains natural gas, but for many years there was sort of no way to get to it. So it's the development of this hydrofracking technology that has made this possible.
And you go into that hydrofracking technology a bit. But I want to hold that in abeyance for a second, because I want to introduce your characters first, because they are really the ones who experience so vividly the effects of fracking. Tell us first about Rich Devlin and then his wife, Shelby.
Sure. Rich is, in many ways, the center of the book. He's a guy who works in a prison. He's born and raised in this town. His father was a coal miner. And he is one of the young people who stayed. He got married and is raising a family there. He owns a piece of land and leases the mineral rights early in the book. And a lot of the story traces what happens next.
He has plans for the farm, the property on which he lives. And that leads him into a devil's bargain, in a way.
It does. So this piece of land that Rich has belonged to his grandfather, and it was at one time a family dairy farm. And Rich gets together the money to buy out his siblings after his grandfather dies, and so he owns this land, but he cannot afford to farm it, which is really his dream. So he's working full-time at this prison. He works in the evenings at his father's tavern, helping his father out. He has no time to go into farming, and he has no money to cover startup costs. So when he has the opportunity to lease his mineral rights, he sees this as his only exit strategy from this rather difficult life he's trapped in. It's the only way he can imagine ever being able to farm this land.
And so who are the folks who come in to lease his land? And explain what it means to lease land. I mean, it's leasing land or the mineral rights?
Just the mineral rights. So the people who lease their mineral rights are still living on the land. Some of them are still farming the land. But somebody has bought the rights to whatever is extracted from it for a certain period. So the landowner will get a certain dollar amount per acre and then a percentage of the profits from whatever gas is extracted.
Now, when he leases his land, he leases it for $25 an acre. Talk about that whole process. That seems awfully low.
Well, it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around, because it's the real money comes in the percentage of profits, and that comes later, of course. So the per acre dollar amount is just the money you get up front. What you're counting on is that once these wells start producing, you will have this ongoing cash stream coming in. Rich, like a lot of people who signed mineral leases early on, really did not have a clear idea of what he was signing. He did not get legal counsel. He knew very little about this industry. He basically took the first offer that somebody made. And, of course, later in the book, he finds out that some of his neighbors didn't take the first offer and hung in there longer and were better negotiators and got a much better deal.
And did you talk to people who had been through this process?
I have.
Mm-hmm. So this is not an untypical?
No, it's not. It's happened a lot. I think in the early years of the Marcellus drilling, it happened more. People in these communities have gotten a lot smarter about leases, just learning from other people's experience.
Right. Now, he's got neighbors. Rich Devlin has neighbors, Mac and Rena. They are, I guess you'd call them a gay couple. They're both women, and they're both lovers, partners, really. And they own an organic dairy farm. Tell us a little bit about their situation.
You know, I was very interested in this couple, Mac and Rena. Mac is what a lot of us would call a transgender person. She would never call herself that, and she's never changed her pronouns. So she doesn't refer to herself as him. And yet she lives like a man. And in her relationship with Rena, she functions as a husband. So that is their relation to each other. They've been a couple for quite a long time, since 1979. They're in their 50s, and they've been a happy couple for all these years. But living as a transgender person in a very small town is not the same thing as being transgender in New York City or Boston. So I'm interested in the kinds of accommodations Mac has had to make in order to live in this town. And truly, she is not a person who ever wanted to leave. She's never wanted to live anywhere else. And yet, her life is an uneasy fit with the culture of this town.
And also the choice that they made to be organic dairy farmers, why is that so significant in this book?
Well, as an organic farm, you are dependent on the purity of the water table. You are committed not to using certain pesticides and artificial hormones. You know, you have a set of standards that you have to observe. And what happens if there is gas exploration on your neighbor's property? Your water comes from the same water table theirs does. If something goes wrong, it affects you equally. So Mac and Rena opt not to lease their mineral rights, and yet they are impacted by all these neighbors who decide to do so.
And those neighbors are not all that happy about their decision.
Well, no. And this is a conflict you see early in the book. In order to drill on these properties, the company needs mineral rights to several contiguous properties. So if there is one neighbor who's a holdout, everybody around you has signed a gas lease, but you refuse to, the deal can't go through.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jennifer Haig about her terrific new novel, Heat and Light. It's about what happens to a small Pennsylvania community when the frackers come to town. Yeah, so one of the themes of this book is the transformations that happen to people when something like this happens. I mean, long-time, friendships change. Certainly marriages change. Relationships change. I just wonder if you could say a little bit about your thought process in connecting this profound social change in the community with the personal changes that the characters go through.
Sure. I think it's a truism, but there's a lot of truth in it, that money does change the way people interact with each other. And it's particularly true in this town where nobody's ever had money before. And nobody's ever thought of themselves as a prosperous person. And so it completely shatters all their ways of being and all their ways of seeing themselves.
So now talk a little bit about the company that comes in, Dark Elephant. I just love that name. And so this company comes in. Talk about the impact. What actually happens when, you know, here we have Rich Devlin. What happens to his great surprise when they actually start operations? What happens when you have somebody starting to frack on your land?
Well, the first thing that happens is a crew comes in to strip away the vegetation, to cut down any trees that might be there. The land needs to be level, so in terrain like western Pennsylvania that's very mountainous, you need a crew to come in and smooth it down, basically steamroll it. So the whole topography of his property changes almost overnight so that they can move this giant drill rig in. Another thing that happens a lot in western Pennsylvania, the roads are narrow and winding, and a lot of them are simply not wide enough to accommodate a drill rig, so a lot of new roads have to be built. So that's the first thing that happens. When the drilling itself starts, the main disturbance I hear about from people is the noise, and the noise is really epic. It's hard to convey how overpowering it is. So the noise is particularly problematic for Rich Devlin because he works at night. This is a prison guard who works the night shift, comes home, and needs to get some sleep. And he finds this virtually impossible once the drilling starts.
And also there's light as well.
Right. They're like stadium lights, you know, that kind of light that there's no blocking it out. They work 24/7. This is a very expensive operation, so once it starts, it's not going to stop until it's complete. So it's relentless. It simply never stops.
And what happens to the air?
Nothing.
No, really?
Not really. I mean, there are a lot of trucks. There's a lot of truck traffic, so there are diesel fumes. Mm-hmm. But that's not the primary danger. The primary danger is what can happen to the water table. And to be honest, it does not always happen. Most of the time, it does not. In most of the places where fracking has been done, the water is fine. When it's not fine, it's really not fine. It is desperately not fine. So that's the risk you're running.
Now, You also go back in time to another accident, one I remember very well because I was actually pregnant at the time and living in New York City. I actually had to leave for a couple of weeks because of the plume. And we're talking now of Three Mile Island, the nuclear accident there. Why did you decide to incorporate Three Mile Island into your book?
Well, this is really integral to the story. Pennsylvania is an energy state. It's always been an energy state. And in order to understand the reaction of people there to this gas drilling prospect, you need to look pretty far back. The first oil well in the world was drilled in Pennsylvania. Coal companies ran roughshod over the state for 150 years. Then there was strip mining. Then there was Three Mile Island. So Pennsylvania is no stranger to the consequences of energy exploration, and that's really what the book is about. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the way the novel starts, it's with that first oil well being drilled in the 1850s in western Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It goes a long way toward explaining why people in Pennsylvania seem to have a greater tolerance for the kind of environmental degradation that can happen with coal mining, with strip mining, with gas drilling, with nuclear power. I think people in Pennsylvania view it in a binary way, that any prosperity that has ever come to that region has come with a certain price to the environment. So people imagine that it's a choice between being prosperous and dirty or being pristine and poor. And for the last 25 years, there's been no coal mining, there's been very little strip mining, there's been no economic activity. Western Pennsylvania is cleaner than it's ever been and poorer than it's ever been.
And yet there is opposition. There are activists in Pennsylvania, not just Josh Fox. And by the way, I did see his terrific new movie about climate change the other day and got to meet him. You know, he talks about the loss of, the loss of the world that we had. This is a loss that your characters also feel, yeah. Even if people have this Hobbesian choice to make, there's still a real sorrow that attends it.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that is suffused throughout the book. It's a terrible position to be in. And economic desperation forces people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the other fact about it, though, is that even the economic gain is not secure by any means. The boom and bust cycles of the fossil fuel extraction industries is something that is happening right now. So what about that impact on the people in Bakerton or the communities like Bakerton?
It's been a great blow. This whole gas exploration project is market-driven in a way that people don't really understand and were not prepared for. When people signed these agreements, when they leased their mineral rights, there was no understanding that this was subject to the whims of the market. Heat and Light is very much a novel about complicated machines. And you see the complication of the frack rigs, the extraordinary complexity of the reactor at Three Mile Island. And it's also another of those machines is the financial market. It's another one of those machines that is so complex that even the people who do this for a living understand imperfectly and incompletely and are often disastrously wrong about. And so for people who've leased their mineral rights, the current bust cycle that we're in right now was not at all what they thought they were signing up for.
Hmm. You know, I sensed in this book, and I have read maybe not all, but I think most of your books, they're absolutely terrific. This one seemed to burn white hot with a passionate sense of injustice. Not in a way that made the fiction any worse, but actually made it better, you know, which I think doesn't always happen when one burns with that. Am I picking up something that's true?
I think it's true. You know, it's a book about a controversial issue, but it's not a screed. And I think that's the danger when you're writing issue-driven fiction. I'm not interested in writing villains. I don't believe I've ever written a villain. And I think they are rare in actual life. Even people who do terrible things believe they have legitimate reasons for doing so. So when I'm writing the characters in this book, no matter what side of the fracking debate they happen to be on, I'm writing them with empathy. And I think that is key. To me, writing fiction is an exercise in empathy. And so what you're seeing on the page is the magic of point of view. Whenever I'm working on a particular character, I take her side completely. I agree with her completely. I see the world through her eyes. Even if next week I'm writing a different character who holds the opposite view, then I see the character through his eyes. So that's my role as the writer. Whatever convictions I might have about the issues I'm writing about, all that has to be put aside because I'm writing these people from the inside out.
Yes, that's true with characters, but there are points in the book where you are writing. It's not a character. It's not from their point of view. You know, I'm thinking especially when you're talking about Three Mile Island, when you're talking about the ways decisions are made in the system, in the fossil fuel industry, in the market, how decisions are made, and that machine just grinds people up. And that's where I sense the passion in this book.
I think you're right. That's me.
Could you say a little more about that?
Well, it's something I feel strongly about. This is, in many ways, a book about class. I think all my novels are, in some way, books about class, but this one is particularly acute. I'm writing about characters who are making the best decisions they can with very limited power. By and large, these people are not power brokers, they are pawns. And what I'm doing in some of these more authorial chapters is panning way, way back and looking at this whole operation from some distance and trying to give a sense of the scale of the thing.
Yeah, and I think you do that so well. I think that's what kicks up the intensity of the novel, although the characters themselves and what happens to them is just terrific. I mean, you really feel that you know them from the inside. I just cannot recommend this book enough. Heat and Light. Jennifer Haig, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about this book.
Thank you for having me, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
Jennifer Haig. Her new novel is Heat and Light. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, the true story of an oil patch industry insider and her fight against fracking. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Jessica Ernst began her career as an oil patch consultant, she never imagined that she would end up on the other side of a lawsuit from her former clients. They include Encana, one of the world's biggest natural gas producers. But when Encana started a risky method of fracking for natural gas in Canada's Alberta province, called slickwater fracking, they ended up contaminating a shallow aquifer used by the rural community with natural gas and toxic chemicals where Jessica Ernst lived. When her well water turned into a flammable broth that even her dogs refused to drink, she sued her former clients for violating the law, and she sued regulatory agencies for letting them do it. The suit has made her a folk hero in many places worldwide where fracking is underway. Andrew Nikiforuk tells the story of Ernst's fight to hold the frackers accountable in his book Slick Water. He interweaves her story with the science of fracking and other stories of human and environmental impacts left in fracking's wake. Elizabeth Kolber called the book, quote, a true life noir filled with corruption, incompetence, and ultimately courage. Andrew Nikiforuk has written extensively about the impact of dirty energy. His books include Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, and The Energy of Slaves, Oil and the New Servitude. Slick Water was a finalist for the 2015 Shaughnessy Cohen Prize for Political Writing. It's out from Greystone Books and the David Suzuki Institute. Andrew Nikiforuk, welcome to Writer's Voice.
My pleasure.
Now, you start your book, Andrew Nikiforuk, Slick Water, with Ross Dress for Less. This was an explosion that happened in a store called Ross Dress for Less. So this happened in California. Talk about that, and why did you start your book with that disaster?
Well, the disaster happened in the 1980s, and it's an illustration of actually how long the oil and gas industry and regulators have known about the hazards of fracking. And in this case, Los Angeles, the city, lies over top of scores of old oil and gas basins. And the city has actually been built up on top of these old oil fields. And there are abandoned well sites all over the place, in some cases right in the basements of buildings. And in the 1960s and 1970s, industry went back into a lot of these formations and started to do a lot of fracking. And they were using, in some cases, natural gas, or they were using water to flood some of these formations and to open more fractures and release more oil and gas. And in the process of doing this, near the Dress for Less store, one company drove an enormous amount of methane through natural fractures to the surface, and a lot of this methane infiltrated a clothing store, which then blew up when a janitor flicked on a switch and caused a spark, and with the result that the building just about collapsed. Nearly 20 people were injured, some of them quite badly burned in this incident. And at the time, industry sort of said, well, hey, this is not really a problem. This methane was all natural anyway. It was just in the ground. It was swamp gas, and not to worry about it. And that was even the report that the state and the regulators came up with. When, in fact, a lot of scientists and a lot of petroleum geologists said, well, that's nonsense. This was not a natural event. And this event, in fact, was a classic case of industry fracturing the ground, creating more fractures, not knowing where all these fractures would lead or go, with the result that methane from industry wells traveled very rapidly and in large volumes into a commercial district of the city and caused a near catastrophe.
So talk about fracking itself. It seems that there are different kinds of fracking. There's, you mentioned in the book, coal bed methane. There's this oil fracking, there's natural gas fracking, and then on top of all of this, a whole big shift into what's called unconventional methods or unconventional fracking. So give us a brief overview of what fracking is and what it really means, what these different methods mean.
So, hydraulic fracturing is, as industry itself describes it, a brute force technology. It's a highly unpredictable and imprecise use of force. And in this case, the force is all about injecting fluids such as water or fluids such as CO2 or natural gas or fluids such as diesel fuel or even napalm was a very common frack fluid at one point into the ground at very high pressures and high speeds. With the idea of cracking a rock open, the same way you might use a hammer to split a rock open. And the problem with this technology is that you can't always control where all the fractures are going to go. There's no computer model that will predict where the fractures in this rock will take place. In fact, again, Baker Hughes and Schlumberger and other companies their senior administrators will admit that, you know, there's a bit of a problem with fracking in the sense that about 60% of all frack jobs, so this is where you're injecting fluid at high pressures into the ground to crack rock, actually don't do their job. They frack out a zone, they are unsuccessful, and are wasteful uses of energy. So the technology itself is only hitting the target zone about 40% of the time. And so when it's not hitting the target zone, it is causing earthquakes, or it is infiltrating into groundwater or other water zones, or quite often, I mean, it's not unusual for companies to frack directly into other oil and gas wells that are nearby. So fracking is a very clumsy example of force. And the remarkable thing about it is that really industry has been fracking since the 1860s, 1870s. And the original frack jobs took place after the Civil War, and they all involved the use of torpedoes that would be shot down into the ground, and they would be filled with black powder or nitroglycerin, and these would go into very shallow wells with the idea of blowing up the bottom of the well to increase oil production. And you know, the technology has evolved over time, but really the evolution has consisted solely of applying more and more force. So, you know, in the 1950s, a typical frack job would be at a vertical well site, might involve 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel or napalm, and you would require 600 horsepower to inject that into the ground. Today, it's not uncommon to inject 5 million gallons, 10 million, 15, 20 million gallons of water or other fluids into the ground and using and requiring horsepower of up to 60,000 pumping power on the surface to inject it into the ground. So an industry that used to look like a canoe, now operates like, you know, a nuclear power plant in terms of its size and impact.
It seems to be incredibly wasteful of water.
Extraordinarily wasteful of water. The average frack job in the United States needs about 5 million gallons. The average frack job in northern Canada now is up to 20 million gallons. We don't know where all that water goes. A lot of it is not recovered. And in areas where there has been a lot of intensive fracking, the industry can change the level of groundwater, can change the amount of surface water, and can make a place like Texas, which is already has water issues, can make those much more severe.
Wow. So now this book, Andrew Nikiforuk, Slick Water, really focuses on one main story, although you do go into a lot of the history of fracking and other issues too. But this is the incredible story of Jessica Ernst, an oil patch consultant of all ironies, let's say, although it actually positioned her perfectly to be able to become a formidable opponent to this industry. Tell us who she was and, you know, how did she get involved in this epic battle?
Well, she's an extraordinary woman, and in many ways, I would argue that the book is actually a tale about the courage of women. And Jessica Ernst did not go looking for this fight, did not want to have any part of it, really. She had been employed by the oil patch for more than 20 years. She ran a very successful business, an environmental consulting business. She had worked in Alberta and in northern British Columbia for some of North America's largest oil and gas companies. Chevron was at one time one of her clients. Encana, one of the largest shale gas developers, was one of her clients. The Great Canadian Oil Sands Company, Murphy Oil, you know, these are all very powerful and significant players in the patch. And she worked for them all. And like many people in the patch, she thought that the industry was well regulated and that the regulators would uphold the law and do what they were mandated to do. But what she discovered in 2004, when the industry began fracking shallow coal seams around her home in Rosebud, Alberta, in the central part of the province, really shocked her. For starters, the regulator was not interested at all in in looking at cumulative impacts of essentially drilling a coal seam with tens of thousands of wells, because that was what industry felt would be required to get the methane out of there. And of course, Jessica thought, well, this will be highly disruptive to the farmers and ranchers and agricultural communities occupying the surface. And she was stunned when she and her community went to the regulator and asked for a cumulative impact assessment. And they said, no way, we're not going to bother with that. And she was even more stunned when she started to complain about the noise from compressor stations needed to vacuum this methane up from the ground, when the regulator ignored, again, its rules and regulations on the noise that could be permitted from these facilities.
And talk about that noise. I mean, it sounds like this was not your garden variety of, maybe a background hum.
No, this is a completely irritating drone that could actually drive you crazy over time. And in fact, there have been, thousands of complaints about compressor stations throughout North America. When industry has not properly constructed them or tried to adequately mitigate the noise they make. And in this case, Encana was not prepared to mitigate the noise, despite scores and scores of complaints from both Jessica and her neighbors. And so Jessica then started to think, what's wrong here? Why am I losing faith in my own industry as well, in its regulator? And then everything really fell apart when she discovered that she had extraordinary amount of methane in her groundwater as the result of the shallow fracking that was taking place all around her. And her water changed completely. It became as fizzy as 7-Up. Her dogs wouldn't drink it. She was getting burns on her skin whenever she'd take a bath or a shower. And it was actually a friend, a heavy oil geologist, who one day was visiting and said, "Jess, there's so many bubbles in your water, in your tap water. I don't believe this. It used to be great. It was phenomenal water. Something has happened to it. So you've either got CO2 in your water or methane. You better have it checked out." And of course she didn't. And that's when she discovered she actually had explosive levels of methane in her water well. And when she brought that issue to the regulator, the response of the regulator was incredible. They said, "Look, lady, we've had enough of you and your complaints. We think that you are now a criminal threat and a security threat to this organization. So we are banishing you. We will have no further communication with you." And they sent her a letter to this effect at the same time that she discovered she had explosive levels of methane in her water.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with environmental journalist Andrew Nikiforuk about his latest book, Slick Water. So let's just be clear here. When you say regulator, well, first of all, who were they? Were these provincial regulators? What was this regulator, and what were they supposed to be doing?
Well, the regulator is called the Alberta Energy Regulator, and it would be like the Railroad Commission in Texas. And these regulators are responsible for regulating the activities of the oil and gas industry. And the Railroad Commission does this in Texas. The Oil and Gas Commission in Wyoming does it there. The Colorado has an Oil and Gas Commission as well. And Alberta has the Alberta Energy Regulator. These are very, very powerful regulators. And in many cases, they have been totally captured by the oil and gas industry. They are there to facilitate development and to make it very difficult for anyone who encounters problems with the industry to bring their problems forward or have them resolved. And that is exactly what Jessica Ernst discovered as she started dealing with the Alberta Energy Regulator.
Now, she did not act alone completely. I mean, she wasn't the only one suffering the impacts. Talk about how this company, Encana, dealt with the community, dealt with the farmers, and then what their response was. In other words, how she and other people began to come together. So take it first. When they went out to the community, how did they deal with it?
Well, Encana's approach to this was typical of the industry in the sense that they knew that in order to develop or extract this methane from coal seams, they would have to drill a lot of wells, and that the well density on the landscape would change from maybe, you know, 2 wells a section to 4 to 6 to 8 or even 12 or 16 wells per section. So rather than address this issue with the local communities, they actually lied to the communities. And they said, don't worry, we're actually not fracking here. And, you know, there's not much methane here anyway. It's probably all leaked out of the outcrops and in the coal seams in this field. You know, they outright lied. And so the community got up in arms, and they forced the company to actually hold a public meeting on this very issue. And, you know, it wasn't until years later that the company actually admitted what they were up to and what they were trying to do. And by that point, they had already drilled thousands of wells. And they had made it impossible to establish a critical baseline in terms of, well, how much methane is already in the groundwater and how much is industry now adding to it with all of this fracking, as well as from leaks from older oil and gas wells throughout the area. And there were thousands of those. And the research has shown consistently throughout the last 10 years that the more you frack a landscape that contains a lot of old oil and gas wells, the more you will rattle those wells and their well bores, and the more methane leaks you will have. And that's exactly what happened in Rosebud too. And so in the beginning, I mean, Jessica Ernst was not alone. Her community was very supportive of the questions she was asking. But then Encana very cleverly divided the community by saying, look, all right, guys, maybe we've made a few mistakes here and we've got off on the wrong path. How about if we donate $150,000 to the Rosebud Theater? And Rosebud is a very small community of 110 people and has this wonderful summer theater that thousands of people from Calgary come to every year. And they said, well, you know, why don't we donate this money to the theater and let bygones be bygones and leave it at that. And so this payment essentially bought off a lot of people in the community who thought, well, we better not say anything more, because if we do, we'll endanger this valuable funding for the theater. And a number of people had pointedly told Jessica Ernst at this point just to shut up and go away. And that sort of began a divorce between her and her community that lasted several years and has recently ended as her community has come back and said, you know what, Jess, you were right all along.
So then what happened from there? She gets banished. She can't even talk to the regulators anymore. What happened?
Well, it was that, you know, at that point, she began to realize, okay, I am not going to get justice from the regulators, either from Alberta Energy regulator or from the provincial government, which had some responsibility to investigate groundwater contamination. And she realized that if she wanted to hold the authorities accountable here, because in fact she discovered that they had broken the law, not upheld the law, because at this time it was illegal to frack into groundwater and produce water as Encana did, that she would have to sue the players involved. And so it took her a couple of years to assemble the courage, as well as to assemble a legal team that she trusted. And so about 8 years ago, she sued the regulator, she sued Encana, and she sued the Alberta government for negligence in regards to groundwater contamination. And that then began another chapter in her life, which is this very long and torturous lawsuit, which the regulator and the company have fought tooth and nail. And both regulator and government and industry also have access to enormous amounts of cash and very large legal teams. And they have managed to keep this case tied up in the courts to the point where not one shred of evidence has yet been entered into court.
Even now?
Even now. It tells you a bit about how convoluted and difficult the Canadian court system really is. And one of the big issues here is the regulator has argued that, look, we have an immunity clause that says that we're not liable to any civil suits. So, you know, even if we you know, poison somebody's livestock or if we contaminate groundwater, there's no way they can sue us because, hey, we've got an immunity clause. And Jessica Ahern said, that's wrong. That's not right. And I'm going to challenge that. And she has. And in fact, she's actually taken that challenge all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, which recently heard her case last month. And in all likelihood, they're going to rule that this immunity clause is not valid because it contradicts and undermines Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And yes, the regulator is liable and will have to go back to court. But that the Supreme Court will not make its ruling for another 4 or 5 months. So in the meantime, her case sort of remains in legal limbo, even though technically the lawsuit against the government and against the in Canada continues.
She did win a judgment, though, didn't she?
Yes, she did. I mean, she's won a number of judgments. And what they basically said, you know what, Jess? Your challenge of the immunity clause that the Alberta Energy regulator says protects it from any legal action can be questioned and should be examined by higher court. And that gave her the Supreme Court hearing.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with environmental journalist Andrew Nikiforuk about his latest book, Slick Water. Now, there's recently been a change in the government of Canada with Justin Trudeau winning the, is it called Prime Minister?
Yes, he's the Prime Minister, yes, which would be right. Like your president, yep.
Right. Do you foresee any change? Because I think very much your book, Andrew Nikiforuk, Slick Water, really does chart how Canada became what some people have called a climate criminal under the government of Stephen Harper. And I just wonder what you think, whether there are going to be any changes coming down the pike here with a change in government.
That's a good question. And I think it's too early yet to tell what kind of changes we're going to see. Certainly, the new prime minister has said, look, I believe in that climate change is a real existential threat to our economy and our future as a species. And yes, we must do something about it. Yet, on the other hand, he remains supportive of fracking. He remains supportive of pipelines. And he somehow thinks that the hydrocarbon industry in Canada can expand at the same time that the nation does something about climate change. And I think that's not going to be a very successful position for the prime minister to take. And in Jessica Ahern's case, the federal government has actually changed its position. I mean, it was at one point prepared to intervene legally on the side of the Alberta Energy Regulator and to defend its immunity clause. But when Prime Minister Trudeau came to power, it withdrew any involvement in the Supreme Court case in this matter. So that's a positive change and one that was certainly welcomed by Jessica Ernst.
Now, you focus this book very much on her case. How much is what she did, how does it fit within a movement against fracking in Canada?
Well, her case is really, I think, an everyman's case in the sense that, you know, and it really would be no difference in Pennsylvania or Wyoming or Texas, where the industry has also contaminated groundwater. She caught the industry red-handed. She caught the regulators not doing their jobs. She caught the regulators performing fraudulent investigations, and she caught the regulator disobeying the law. And what makes her case so powerful is that in other cases in the United States, in Pennsylvania and Texas and elsewhere, landowners who have encountered exactly the same problems and the same appalling treatment by regulators have settled out of court. So the companies have come forward and they've said, look, here's a check. Sorry about all this, but here's a check. Oh, and by the way, we'll deliver you some water, but you must sign here. And if you sign here, you must agree to not speak about groundwater contamination or any other consequences of fracking on your property. And in some cases, the agreements actually state that their children's children must not talk about this contamination. And what makes Jessica unique is that she has said up front from the very beginning that she will not settle out of court for money, that she wants all the evidence brought to the table. And this makes her case really, really important. You know, one of the critical things here is that when you look at the Catholic Church and how it covered up the abuses of pedophile priests, it used exactly the same legal mechanism that the oil and gas industry is using today to cover up the systematic abuse of groundwater from the technology of hydraulic fracturing. And it all comes down to these confidentiality clauses. So in places like Boston, where priests abused children, the bishop would send a lawyer to the family, offer the family money, and in return, the family would sign a non-disclosure agreement that would allow the parish to move the priest to another parish so that the abuse could happen somewhere else. And this is exactly the same mechanism the oil and gas industry uses throughout North America. There have been thousands of these confidentiality agreements signed, and Jessica Ernst is one of the very few people who is willing to say, enough is enough. We must stop this legal abuse, and we must stop covering up the contamination of a public resource, and that public resource is groundwater.
Wow. Now, I have one last question. You mentioned in the book that Canada has obligations under NAFTA to continue to frack?
Canada has obligations under NAFTA to supply the United States with a certain percentage of oil and gas. 90% of all oil and gas wells today are of such poor and inferior quality that they must be fracked.
And so is this something that is also in other international trade agreements? Is this a kind of typical thing? In other words, it seems like there's a dead weight of the fossil fuel industry. If you can be sued for not supplying these, how would Canada be able to shut down its fracking?
So it's known as a proportionality clause, which guarantees the United States a proportion of our energy production based on what we have exported in the past. Mexico did not sign that part of NAFTA, but we did. And yes, it could easily serve as a major constraint on Canada in terms of cutting back oil and gas production in response to the whole climate change threat. I mean, fortunately at the moment, you know, the United States is using less of our natural gas, although it is still importing a lot of our oil, particularly from the tar sands, and converting that oil into other hydrocarbons, such as jet fuel and gasoline, which it is then exporting around the world. So, I mean, the United States is using a lot of our very ultra-heavy bitumen as a feedstock, refinery feedstock, that it then turns into more value-added goods for export around the world.
Well, it's a terrific story. Andrew Nikiforuk, the book is Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. I want to thank you very much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much, Francesca. I greatly enjoyed it.
Andrew Nikiforuk. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Slick Water. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.